I don't have to repeat the last three sessions. But my name is Esther Mann, for those of you who have bad memories. This week is The Power of the Powerless, Women Who've Shaped Biblical History. Today we're going to look at stories of conquest of the Promised Land. And I had originally planned to do Rahab, but in preparing for this session, I thought, well, it'd be interesting to do three women, Rahab, Deborah, and Yael, because you have three different roles in the conquest that women have taken. And I thought it would be interesting to look at these stories because in all of them, women take very strong positions and they play very important roles in the conquest of Canaan. And I think it may shake up some of our ideas that we've had in the 19th and 20th century of women as somehow being more compassionate, more, I don't know, loving or whatever. And it, to me anyway, these stories emphasize that both men and women have been involved in our history and both are accountable for what's gone on. And when we critique some of, perhaps we'll have time for reflection, but when we critique some of these traditions of conquest, women are also part of it. We're part of humanity, not somehow outside of it. So let's look first of all at the story of Rahab, and that is in the book of Joshua. Now, by turning to the book of Joshua, we're leaving the first five books of the Bible, which is traditionally known as the Torah in the Jewish tradition. These are the five books that are usually ascribed to the Mosaic authorship. And in the Jewish community, these five books, the five books of Moses, are primary in sort of kind of a hierarchy. They're the most important books in the Hebrew Bible, and or in the Old Testament, our Old Testament, their Bible. They are read every year entirely. So if you go to services, they're read completely all the way through, and that's no other books of the Bible are read in this fashion all the way through. So they are the most important. And I find it interesting and significant that they end with Moses looking over into the Promised Land from the outside. There's not, if you look at the broader shape of these five books, there's not a triumphant entry into the land and taking over the land, but rather it ends with the promise unfulfilled. And I think that's significant in the kind of, in the way the Bible feels or in the way the story reads, because it's the main part doesn't end with this kind of triumphal entry. But when we move to Joshua, we do have the entry of the Promised Land. And it's interesting that the book of Joshua depicts the conquest as a quick and total conquest of all the people, with God doing the fighting here. It's kind of a holy war. When we continue on and look at Judges, we have maybe a more realistic picture. People remain in the land, and there are a number of different battles. So Joshua's kind of how the story would have gone if it had been ideal here. It's sort of an idealization of the story. And in the first chapter, we have the people getting ready to cross over. In the second chapter, which we'll look at right now, we have Joshua sending some spies over into the land to see what's going on in Jericho, to test out the waters here. So the people are over here, and they're getting ready here to cross over into Jericho, which is in a flat area down here. Just an aside, you might be interested to know that the name Joshua, who's Moses' successor, that's actually the Hebrew form of Jesus. So Jesus' name was Joshua, and it means God save, God save. So just a sort of a Bible trivia that might be of interest to you. So Joshua sends a couple of spies. And let's read this story. The biblical stories are so well written and interesting. Let's read here 2, 1 through 7. Someone who likes to read, please read.
And Joshua the son of Nun sent 2 men secretly from Shittim as spies, saying, "Go, view the land, especially Jericho." And they went and came into the house of a harlot whose name was Rahab, and lodged there. And it was told the king of Jericho, "Behold, certain men of Israel have come here tonight to search out the land." Then the king of Jericho sent to Rahab, saying, "Bring forth the men that have come to you, who entered your house, for they have come to search out all the land." But the woman had taken the 2 men and hidden them, and she said, "True, men came to me, but I did not know where they came from." And when the gate was closed at dark, the men went out. Where the men went, I do not know. Pursue them quickly, for you will overtake them. But she had brought them up to the roof and hid them with the stalks of flax which she laid in order on the roof. So the men pursued after them on the way to the Jordan as far as the forts, and as soon as the pursuers had gone out, the gate was shut.
Great. Yeah, that's super. Okay, so we have the spies being sent out, and they go right to this house here, where Rahab presides, house of a harlot, house of a prostitute. And she ends up hiding these people here. We have here, in the discussion of the walls and so forth, we have a depiction of cities. The walled cities, it was very traditional for the cities to have very strong walls to protect them from invasion. And notice that the gate is closed at night and that's it. You can't get in or out, you know, to protect the town from foreign invasion here. So she hides them, and we get her reasoning here as the story continues. Could somebody please read 2:8 on to 14?
This is from the New ISV. Before they went to sleep, she came up to them on the roof and said to them, "I know that the Lord has given you the land, and that dread of you has fallen on us, and that all the inhabitants of the land melt and fear before you. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea before when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the 2 kings of the Amorites that were beyond the Jordan, to Sihon and Og, whom you utterly destroyed. As soon as we heard it, our hearts melted, and there was no courage left in any of us because of you. The Lord your God is indeed God in heaven above and on earth below. Now then, since I have dealt kindly with you, swear to me by the Lord that you will turn and deal kindly with my family. Give me a sign of good faith that you will spare my father and mother, my brothers and sisters, and all who belong to them, and deliver our lives from death." The men said to her, "Our life for yours. If you do not tell this business of ours, then we will deal kindly and faithfully with you when the Lord gives us the land."
Okay, good. So here, this is interesting. Here we have a little testimonial to the power of the Hebrew God, and it's put in the mouth of this foreign woman here. And that's actually a fairly common literary technique in the Hebrew Bible. You'll have people like Balaam, who's a foreign prophet. He's called to curse the Israelites by this foreign king, Beor, over in Moab. And Balaam ends up blessing the people and talking about how wonderful their God is and so forth. You also have King Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonian king, who attests to the power of God and so forth. So it's a kind of a powerful statement by an outsider of the strength of the Hebrew God here. But let's continue on and finish the story, and then we'll have a discussion here. Why don't somebody read from 15 on to the end there? Great.
And then she let them down by the court through the window, for her house was upon the town wall, and she dwelt upon the wall. And she said unto them, Get you to the mountains, lest the pursuers meet you, and hide yourselves there 3 days, until the pursuers be returned, and afterward may you go your way. And the men said unto her, We will be blameless of this thine oath, which thou hast made us swear. Behold, when we come into the land, thou shalt bind this line of scarlet thread in the window, which thou didst let us down by. And thou shalt bring thy father and thy mother and thy brethren and all thy father's household home unto thee. And it shall be that whosoever shall go out of the doors of thy house into the street, his blood shall be upon his head, and we will be guiltless. And whosoever shall be with thee in the house, his blood shall be on our head, if any hand be upon him. And if thou utter this our business, then we will quit with thine oath, which thou hast made us swear. And she said, According unto your words, so be it. And she sent them away, and they departed. And she bound the scarlet line in the window. And they went, and came unto the mountain, and abode there 3 days, until the pursuers were returned. And the pursuers sought them throughout all the way, but found them not. So the two men returned, and descended from the mountain, and passed over, and came to Joshua the son of Nun, and told him all these things that befell them. And they said unto Joshua, Truly the Lord hath delivered into our hands all the land, for even all the inhabitants of the country do faint because of us.
Okay, thanks. So here we have not the first red light district, but the red cord district. House marked here. And just to refresh your memories about what happens to her then, we have to skip over a few chapters, but the third chapter here is kind of interesting. If you have time to read it yourself, you'll find it's interesting because the people enter into the land. They cross over the Jordan River here, and it's sort of a reenactment of the Exodus because it says that the priests bearing the Ark of the Covenant, when they crossed, then the waters of the Jordan heaped up like a wall, and the people passed on dry land. So entering into the land is a sort of reenactment of the story of the Exodus and the crossing of the Reed Sea on dry land. And they then set up a memorial here of this event. And finally, they're circumcised again. And then in 6, this is where we'll look here. There's instructions here to fight Jericho. But I'm sure you remember the story of how the people circled around for 6 days, and on the 7th day they shouted and circled 7 times, and then the walls fell down. It's rather exciting way of doing warfare. But actually it fits into this whole idea of the holy war, of God doing the fighting, and the people are just there while God's doing the battle here. So they do their circlings here. And if we read then from 15 through 27, we'll see what happens to Rahab.
On the 7th day, they rose early at the dawn of day and marched around the city in the same manner 7 times. It was only on that day that they marched around the city 7 times. And at the 7th time, when the priests had blown their trumpets, Joshua said to the people, Shout, for the Lord is giving you the city, and the city and all that is within it shall be devoted to the Lord for destruction. Only Rahab the harlot and all who are with her in her house shall live, because she hid the messengers that we sent. But you keep yourselves from the things devoted to destruction, lest when you have devoted them, you take any of the devoted things and make the camp of Israel a thing for destruction and bring trouble upon it. But all silver, gold, and vessels of bronze and iron are sacred to the Lord. They shall go into the treasury of the Lord. So the people shouted, and the trumpets were blown. As soon as the people heard the sound of the trumpet, the people raised a great shout, and the wall fell down flat, so that the people went up into the city, every man straight before him, and they took the city. Then they utterly destroyed all in the city, both men and women, young and old, ox and sheep and asses, with the edge of the sword. Continue.
Yeah, please.
And Joshua said to the two men who had spied out the land, Go into the harlot's house and bring out from it the woman and all who belong to her, as you swore to her. So the young men who had been spies went in and brought up Rahab and her father and mother and brothers and all who belonged to her. And they brought all her kindred and set them outside the camp of Israel. And they burnt the city with fire and all within it, only the silver and gold and the vessels of bronze and of iron they put into the treasury of the house of the Lord. But Rahab the harlot and her father's household and all who belonged to her, Joshua saved alive. And she dwelt in Israel to this day, because she hid the messengers whom Joshua sent to spy out Jericho. Joshua laid an oath upon them at that time, saying, cursed before the Lord be the man that rises up and rebuilds this city Jericho. At the cost of his firstborn shall he lay its foundation, and at the cost of his youngest son shall he set up its gates. So the Lord was with Joshua, and his fame was in all the land.
Thank you. Okay, so the walls come tumbling down, and Rahab is the only in her family were the only ones spared, and they still dwell among the Israelites here. Actually, she's in the genealogy of Jesus in Matthew 1, too.
Oh, really?
Yeah, uh-huh. Right in there. Jewish tradition, this isn't biblical, but Jewish tradition has it that she married Joshua. Now, this whole incidence of the walls of Jericho coming tumbling down, that's kind of interesting, because people who've tried to do archaeology and correlate archaeology with these stories date these events at around 1200 or so, but we'll date the invasion at around 1200 BC or so. But Kathleen Kenyon and others who have studied Jericho, which was city that was inhabited for centuries, really one of the oldest places that's been inhabited, and I think one of the cities that, the walled cities with the longest period of continuous inhabitation in the world. The walls had already fallen down by about this time, so it's kind of, it's an odd story, and actually it may even be a story that tells that, you know, people got there to Jericho and there were no walls. Possibility. But let's look at the character of Rahab a bit herself. And how would you describe what she does? What's what are her actions and what's her character?
What I find strange is that she's a harlot, but she's living there apparently with her parents and kindred. That, you know, you usually think of harlots as being separate from their families, that have a strong family structure, mm-hmm. and be a harlot seems to be contradictory.
Mm-hmm.
And that it was identified as her house.
It's her house, so
and
she had.
She was living with her father. I mean, maybe this what doesn't mean she's living with her father and her brothers, but you would think that if there were men in the house, it would be identified as their house, not
mm-hmm.
their house.
Mm-hmm. Well, it probably wasn't. She's a harlot.
Yeah, right.
So she has a certain amount of independence and status. I guess she was making her own money and had her own place.
I wondered in reading this what the Hebrew attitude towards harlots or prostitutes
mm-hmm.
are. I mean, Mary
mm-hmm.
Magdalene was a prostitute, and Rahab was, and just the other day, tomorrow. I wonder if the whole connotation of that back then is different than our connotation now, and how that may play on how we're supposed to perceive these women.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the reason they chose her to seek her out was they were looking for a prostitute because they would have the access to information.
Mm-hmm.
She would have had, obviously, the leaders. They chose her specifically, probably, at least from what I've read, because she was well-known and probably one of the most beautiful or whatever, and that the city officials would have frequented there, and she had had access to all this reconnaissance information that the soldiers needed to take over the city.
Mm-hmm.
So it was no accident that they would go to her.
Mm-hmm.
She was very shrewd because she used the knowledge she had to earn the freedom of her and her family.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't because, I don't think it was at all because they looked kindly upon prostitutes. Certainly they did in the Jews of Jesus' day because they killed them.
Mm-hmm.
And they stoned them to death.
Yeah, and there's also prohibitions against prostitutes in the Old Testament too.
Yeah.
Although if you look at some of the stories, there seems to be kind of an acknowledgement, okay, there's always prostitutes, and you know, they're sort of outside of the family structures, and as long as there's not as long as it's kind of separate from your basic, you know, family structures and so forth, then there's a sort of a toleration or something.
Basically, they were using each other, though. They needed the information she had, and she needed freedom for her and her family, so they each got something out of the deal.
Mm-hmm. Someone in the earlier class suggested that maybe, and this doesn't quite fit with what your interpretation here, but they suggested that maybe since she was a prostitute and was sort of outside of the mainstream, that she didn't have the kind of alliance to her countrymen because she was a marginalized person. Your interpretation is a little bit different there, because you're saying that she was within the most, or kind of a center there, but this other interpretation was saying that maybe because she was marginalized, she didn't feel that kind of loyalty to the people of the place. But in any event, it would be a place where foreigners could come and be welcome, could spend the night, you know, in a city. And they didn't have, hotels weren't real, I don't think they had hotels actually during that time, so this would be the closest thing. And yeah, it's funny that they never go out and do much spying. It just says they go into the inn and then they go back, and whatever, you know, Rahab's told them about the fear of the land, that's what they repeat. So their scouting is kind of cushy in a way. You know, they go and spend the night and come back.
Hopefully not too cushy.
All right. Right. Well, I don't know. Some speculation there, too. Okay, so more things about Rahab's character and actions here.
But your comment about the fact that they were tolerated, but they're outside the family life. That again makes it interesting that one of the key elements here is her protection of her family.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she does seem to be responsible for a larger family unit. Right. Mm-hmm.
And had her family rejected her, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Previously, as a harlot.
Yeah.
That could happen even today. I mean, prostitutes, they would be, you know, want to protect their families, even though their families had abandoned them.
Mm-hmm.
And how did she know her families would want their freedom at the cost of Jericho?
Right. You know? She's really trading Jericho for her family's safety,
yeah.
In a way. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's yeah, go ahead.
Halfway through verse 18, my understanding is that, well, I'll read it. Unless you bring your father, your mother, your brothers, and all your father's household to your own home. So actually, it was not her father's house that she was in. It was her own home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. 18.
Which,
she said.
Halfway down 18.
What chapter?
Let's say chapter 2.
Chapter 2.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I suspect that probably what existed was more of a caste system where there were different levels. And, you know, she perhaps fell with, and if you looked at the total community, she fell in that lower caste. It doesn't mean that, you know, that she wouldn't have familial bonds and loyalties that she would observe, and unfortunately, that is in fact what happens with marginalized people, that the majority community always attributes to them lack of the values that they hold very dear. And I think from what's here, it's very clear that, you know, she made it clear that the deal was to take care of the whole family, and she took care of that. I do think it's kind of fascinating that in fact, it seems to me that she's obviously commands a position of some leadership.
Mm-hmm.
Now she has the house, and her family followed her lead,
mm-hmm.
and went along with it. So even within her group, she obviously had something, you know, special about her,
mm-hmm.
and not just that she had, you know, knowledge. Which was
somebody spying on her to report who's going from her house, I mean, to report to the authorities, someone unusual is going into her house. somebody's obviously keeping an eye on her.
Who comes and goes.
And that would be consistent.
But you wonder how the whole drama evolved. It took 6 days, 7 days for this wall to fall, and you wonder if at first her brothers and father and stuff are like, she told them, "Well, come here," and they're like, no way, and then maybe by the third day, some of them are getting convinced, and by the sixth day, so there was a period of time that maybe they became convinced of following.
This is really great, because this is like, people talk about, when they study the literature of the Bible, they talk about gaps in the narrative, that the Bible doesn't tell you the whole story. It's like a lot of things that you wonder about, like, okay, well, that's weird. She has a family, how did her family, all these things. It doesn't tell you there's like these gaps in the story. And biblical literature, because it doesn't tell you the whole story, it almost invites participation in the creation of the story. There's a number of different directions, really, that you can take the story in your imagination. And this is a good example of that, sort of inviting character of the biblical story, and even possibility of multiple interpretations at times.
She became the savior of her family, too. Mm-hmm. And I think the scarlet cord, I wonder if, what symbolism that had, because the scarlet cord was tied at the temple on the Day of Atonement, and tradition says that when the lamb was driven into the desert, that turned white. Mm-hmm. And I wondered if the scarlet cord, which is a symbol of atonement and forgiveness, if there isn't something there, because she is savior of the family, if that doesn't have some symbolic value, at least for the Jews.
Mm-hmm.
And also the idea of being reviled and rejected, and then the savior.
It's interesting, Christian interpreters have picked up on that whole scarlet cord imagery too, and I don't know if some of you were here for... on Tuesday, the story of Tamar, and if you remember, the twins were born to Tamar, and one stuck the hand out, and then the scarlet string was put on, and then the other son, Perez, came out first, and Zerah came out with the scarlet cord. And some Christian commentators have kind of followed the scarlet cord as you're doing, and they said, well, this is the birth of two nations, and the first nation born were the Christians who were saved by the blood of Christ, and so that the scarlet cord takes on the connotation of the blood of Christ. But then the Jews were born first, but then the Christians have that cord. And then they tied it also to the Rahab. Maybe that's one of the reasons why she ends up in the genealogy in Matthew, too, because she's associated with this sort of carrying on of the blood of Christ, or that salvation or whatever. But one line of interpretation, anyway, was picked up on that, too. But basically, she's a traitor to her people. When it really comes down to it, she's a traitor. And it's almost as if, the end justifies the means, since this is the story, a legend, a folk tale story of the Jewish people and about the conquest of the land. She becomes a heroine. That, she is a traitor.
You wonder what would happen if the people of Jericho had won the battle, huh? Right. That's a slightly different reading of the events.
Right. Exactly. She'd be put to death, I'm sure. So anyway, this is our first character, and let's move on so we have the full three to look at. Here we have a foreign woman who betrays her own people and aligns with the Israelites, and then is incorporated into the people because of her actions. But now let's turn to Judges 4 and 5, and we'll be introduced to two other women here. This is Deborah and Yael. Judges 4 and 5, Judges 4 and 5, right. Judges, it's right after Joshua. And in Joshua you have this idealized picture of God doing battle and the whole land being won over. Now in Judges, if you were to read the second part of the first chapter, you'd see a little more realistic depiction here. A lot of the peoples and areas are left strong, and the Israelites don't conquer the whole land. They instead live side by side with these other peoples and unconquered cities. And there's occasional warfare then. And the way that the whole thing is structured is that as long as the people, the Israelites, remember who their God is and worship their God, then everything goes okay. But there's a tendency to begin to worship other gods, especially the Baals, the local gods of fertility and agriculture. The Baals and the female counterpart, the Ashtaroth, or Asherot. And when this happens, then it says God raises up an enemy for the Israelites, and then they're attacked. And then the people remember, oh yeah, we have this powerful God, and then they begin praying to God again, and then he'll send them a deliverer or a judge. So judges is charismatic leaders that are raised up primarily as military leaders, then, who lead the people to victory over their enemies. And then during their reign, the people aren't harassed by these other peoples. Now, when we turn to chapter 4, it's interesting. We meet the only female judge, Deborah, and she, besides having a military function, she's the only judge that's described as actually judging, in more in a sense that we would think of it. She sits underneath a tree and people come to her for decisions, you know, when they have conflicts and so forth. So she is actually a judge here. So this is a good story also. Has to do with King Yabin of Canaan. He reigned in Hazor. Now this is a big, if anybody has been to Israel and has been up here, this is a big city too, a huge walled city, very strong. So Yabin's up here, and then his army commander is Sisera, who also lives in the region here. And it says in 3, it says, the Israelites cried out to the Lord, for he had 900 iron chariots, and he had oppressed Israel ruthlessly for 20 years. So iron chariots are like the technology of the day. It would be like our, you know, atomic bomb or something. But you can imagine if you're on foot what 900 iron chariots would do to you, racing through with the horses and everything. You wouldn't have much of a chance, at least in the flatlands. No, up in the mountains, you know, there's a little more of an equal chance. And actually, this whole region here, which it says that the Canaanites had, is a valley, the Jezreel Valley here. This is the Kishon River here. And this was the land that was held by them, whereas the Israelites were dwelling more in the hills up here. But let's read about Deborah. If somebody would read from 4:4 on to about 11.
From the RSV, we have, now Deborah, prophetess, the wife of Lappideth, was judging Israel at that time. She used to sit under the palm of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel in the hill country of Ephraim, and the people of Israel came up to her for judgment. She sent and summoned Barak, the son of Abinadab from Kadesh in Naphtali, and said to him, the Lord, the God of Israel, commands you, go gather your men at Mount Tabor, taking 10,000 from the tribe of Naphtali and the tribe of Zebulun, and I will draw out Sisera, the general of Jabin's army, to meet you by the river Kishon, with his chariots and his troops, and I will give him into your hand. Barak said to her, if you will go with me, I will go. If you will not go with me, I will not go. And she said, I will surely go with you. Nevertheless, the road on which you are going will not lead to your glory, for the Lord will sell Sisera into the hand of a woman. Then Deborah arose and went into Barak to Kadesh, and Barak summoned Zebulun and Naphtali to Kadesh, and 10,000 men went up at his heels, and Deborah went up with him.
Okay, well, yeah, this is a good place to stop. Why don't we stop here? That's good. Okay, so Deborah was a prophet. And it says, the wife of Lappidoth. Now, who's Lappidoth? Who cares? Why, you know, yeah. The wife of Lappidoth. Okay. I don't know who Mr. Lappidoth is. But actually, this is interesting, and this shows
tokenism,
including the male.
Yeah, right.
Well, this
or is it showing that even though Deborah is a prophet and a judge, she still belongs to a man.
She still belongs to a man. Or okay, so it could be a little bit of that patriarchal system, or it could be an argument against patriarchy. Look, you can take it any which way. It could be an argument against patriarchy. Even though she was married, she still had a career. Anyway, no, but actually, what I want to point out is how our translations are influenced as much by our own perceptions as by the possibilities inherent in the Hebrew language. Because the word for woman is isha in Hebrew, and that can be either a woman or a wife. There's no differentiation between the two. Just as man is ish, and you can use that as either a man or a husband. Ish.
Ish.
Isha. Okay, this is the feminine. Now here, this is a slightly different form, but it's the same word, eshet. It's a construct form. It's what you, the form you put in if you're going to use possession. Okay, so she's a woman of, or a wife of, lapidot. Lapidot is the feminine plural for torches. So she's like a woman or a wife of torches. Now, is torches a guy's name? So you say she's the wife of Mr. Torch? Or would you say this is a woman of brilliance, a sparkling, you know, leading type of woman, a fiery woman? Full of, you know, brilliance or whatever. Now, we don't know who Mr. Lapidot is, so it's interesting that I think all of your translations have probably chosen to have her have a husband.
Well, mm-hmm. However, if it was a name, mm-hmm. wouldn't there be some way of indicating a name even in the original text?
Not really, no, No, there's no capital letters.
That's what I meant.
Yeah, there's no
indication of.
No, there's no capital letters, and no, they're just one form of the alphabet. So it's really unclear whether she's Mr. Lapidot's wife or whether she's a woman, a fiery woman, a woman of brilliance, you know. I mean, her nickname is Sparky. They call her Sparky because she's so sharp. So anyway, I just wanted to point this out. She is a fiery woman, you know. So it would make just as much sense. Although this term torches is obscure. It's not used in the plural anyplace else. But on the other hand, it's not a name any other place. So I just wanted to point out that often our interpretations are based on our presuppositions.
It's also odd that if she was married, she would go with another man. Mm-hmm. And the man said, oh, please go with me, and she would, it's okay for mm-hmm. her to go with him.
Well, then what people do is they associate Mr. Lapidot with Barak, mm-hmm. whose name means lightning. Mm-hmm. So then it's like a, you know, like the dynamic duo, husband and wife team, which also, you know, assumes that, what was that?
Sparky and lightning.
Yeah. Sparky and lightning can go off together. Which also assumes that she couldn't, you know, she wasn't up to the task by herself. But anyway, something to think about here. So, and it describes her judging here. She used to sit and receive people and decide cases and so forth. But we also see her then in this prophetic role of summoning the military leaders to battle by indicating, okay, this is the right time. God's going to fight this battle for you. This is it. And we see prophets functioning in this capacity in a number of places in the Hebrew Bible. And notice, once again, it's God who's going to deliver them into the hands of the Israelites. But Barak is a little bit reluctant and asks her to go with him. And then there's this interesting line, however, there will be no glory for you in the course you are taking, for then the Lord will deliver Sisera into the hands of a woman. Which would be a shameful thing to have the women take the glory here. And you kind of think, okay, well, Deborah's going to get the glory, but later we're introduced to yet another woman at the end, Yael. So they come down here and they're gathering at Mount Tabor here. Okay, so there's a little hint that this other woman's going to show up here in chapter 11 where it says, now Heber the Kenite had separated from the other Kenites, and these were perhaps traveling smiths, you know, people that dealt with iron and tools and stuff like that. Descendants of Hobab, the father-in-law of Moses, or brother-in-law of Moses, who had pitched his tent at Elon Bezananim, which is near Kadesh. So we have a little hint that something else is going to happen because we have the introduction of this other group of people that are related to the Israelites. Okay, but now here we have the battle scene. 12 down to 16 here, if somebody would read that. 15? 12 down to 16, I got it.
And Sisera was told that Barak, son of Abinoam, had gone up to Mount Tabor. Sisera called out all his chariots, 900 chariots of iron, and all the troops who were with him, and from Harosheth HaGoyim to the Wadi Kishon. Then Deborah said to Barak, "Up, for this is the day on which the Lord has given Sisera into your hand. The Lord is indeed going out before you." So Barak went down from Mount Tabor with 10,000 warriors following him. And the Lord threw Sisera and all his chariots and all his army into a panic before Barak. Sisera got down from his chariot and fled away on foot, while Barak pursued the chariots and the army to Harosheth HaGoyim. All the army of Sisera fell by the sword, and no one was left.
Mm-hmm. So here we have Deborah urging the men into the battle against these 900 chariots, and the Lord's marching before them. And now, amazingly, notice who's fighting the battle here. The Lord throws Sisera and all his chariots into a panic, and so Sisera flees, and so no longer has the advantage of the superior weaponry here, and they all die. But still you have Sisera chasing along here, and now we're going to be introduced to this third woman that we're going to look at today. So if somebody would read... from here to the end, the story of Yael, the wife of Heber the Kenite.
But Sisera fled away on foot to the tent of Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite, for there was peace between Jabin, the king of Hazor, and the house of Heber the Kenite. And Jael came out to meet Sisera and said to him, "Turn aside, my lord, turn aside to me, have no fear." So he turned aside to her into the tent, and she covered him with a rug. And he said to her, "Pray, give me a little water to drink, for I am thirsty." So she opened a skin of milk and gave him a drink and covered him. And he said to her, "Stand at the door of the tent, and if any man comes and asks you, 'Is anyone here?' say no." But Jael, the wife of Heber, took a tent peg and took a hammer in her hand and went softly to him and drove the peg into his temple till it went down into the ground as he was lying fast asleep from weariness. So he died. And behold, as Barak pursued Sisera, Jael went out to meet him and said to him, "Come, and I will show you the man whom you are seeking." So he went into her tent, and there lay Sisera dead with the tent peg in his temple.
Mm-hmm. Good.
One of the gorier stories.
One of the gorier stories. So it concludes saying that the Canaanites were defeated.
So it went down.
What?
He'd have to blow, and he'd be awake, and she would only got to the
temple. Right here. Right here.
He was weary.
Okay, so, how do you feel when you read this account of it about Yael?
Yeah.
it's interesting because we're told that there was peace at least between her husband and these other people. So
and
why
the king,
did she all of a sudden do this? I mean, it's a difficult thing.
And she enticed him in and he'd be okay.
Mm-hmm. So she seems to offer protection, and he would trust it based on the treaty that there existed between her husband's family and the Canaanites. Mm-hmm.
With friends like that, who has to worry about their enemies?
Right. So there's this element of treachery here that comes out in the story, right? She waits until he's asleep, and then she attacks this poor guy.
What significance is there that he asked for a drink of water, and she didn't give him water, she gave him milk. That's
Mm-hmm. Well,
no, she gave him water from the milk skin. From the skin of milk, isn't it?
Well, it looks like she's giving him water, milk, excuse me. Well, she would have had a lot of milk on hand, probably, because, you know, the goats and everything. So that would have been something that they had in their tents. When we look at the version in the next chapter, we're going to see that it's an act of generosity, or kind of going one step beyond. You know, he asks for water, she gives him milk, you know. So people have also said that this is a, you know, milk. If you drink milk before you go to bed, you sleep really well. This is soporific.
Now, is this also significant in that I know a lot of cultures feel that if you invite somebody to your house and show them, you know, even an enemy to your house, and show them hospitality, then you are supposed to have peace. I mean, at least mm-hmm. during that time that they're in your house, at least mm-hmm. it is triply bad to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so she.
It's like killing somebody in the church.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. The law of hospitality, you were supposed to take care of your guests. And, you know, you have the story of Lot, the men that come visit Lot, and all the people of Sodom come out, and they beat on the door, and they say, send those guys out here. You know, we want to know them. We want to have sex with your visitors. And Lot says, no, take my virgin daughters rather than, you know, harm these guests, because the protection of the guests was so important in this culture. So if you read this in that context also, she's very treacherous here. So you see a lot of a discomfort, I think, in this portrayal of Yael. Well, let's turn to the depiction in the fifth chapter. This is a poetic version, and actually people have said that this is one of the oldest poems we have in the Hebrew Bible, from around 1200 BCE. And it's a very difficult piece of literature. If we were to read the whole thing together, you'd see how different your translations were, because the language is very difficult. But the depiction of Yael is very clear, and I think that you'll see that it's very different from what you have in the later prose version, by which time it seems like the male writers who are describing what happened are very uncomfortable with this whole idea of Yael, you know, that she tricked him in there, and then, you know, he was sleeping, and it seems like the writers almost identify with the male commander here at the hands of Yael. But anyway, let's read the passage in Judges 5. The poetry is much earlier, huh? And it seems to emphasize the perspective of the women much more than.
How do you know it's earlier?
Analyzing the language, for example, the vocabulary. Also analyzing, if you look, there's a list of the different tribes from 14 on down, the tribes that participated, and they aren't, just because of the inclusion of certain tribes and terms for places, it seems to be earlier. The structure of the poetry, things like that. So it's on those kind of bases. So let's read 24 through 27.
This is from the New King James. Most blessed among women is Yael, the wife of Heber the Kenite. Blessed is she among the women in tents. He asked for water, she gave milk. She brought out cream in a lordly bowl. She stretched her hand to the tent peg, her right hand to the workman's hammer. She pounded Caesarea, she pierced his head, she split and struck through his temple. At her feet he sank, he fell, he lay still. At her feet he sank, he fell. Where he sank, there he fell, dead.
Mm-hmm. So you get a different feeling from this.
Not really.
You don't?
It still gives me the creeps.
Yeah. But anyway, you don't have her offering him protection and then
right.
taking it back. It praises her and has him asking for water and her even outdoing it, you know, in this lordly bowl and stuff, so forth. And it almost implies that while he's drinking, that she kills him while he's standing, notice. and, you know, emphasizes her strength. She strikes him, she crushes his head, she smashes and pierces his temple, and then he sinks down between her legs, which is interesting. Okay, it says at her feet in this translation, but it's actually between her legs, bein regleha. Between her legs, he sinks, which, you know, at birth and during sex, women have their power there, and there's sort of an imagery of power. You know, he's sinking down, destroyed. That element of humiliation, of being killed by a woman, that you see other places in Judges too. Like, for example, in Judges 9, there's this guy who's standing, Abimelech, he's standing underneath a wall, and a woman throws down a millstone on his head, and it crushes his head. And I'll try to find the quote here. This is in 53. But a woman dropped an upper millstone on Abimelech's head and crushed his skull. He immediately cried out to his attendant, his arms bearer, "Draw your dagger and finish me off, that they may not say of me, 'A woman killed me.'" So his attendant stabbed him and he died. Okay, and then everybody went home. So, oh, that was in Judges 9:53. Okay, so I think in this poetic version anyway, there's not quite that blaming of her for breaching hospitality, and also her strength is emphasized too. So.
Is there any reason given why she killed her, or what the motivation was?
What do you think? Well, apparently she sided with the Israelites.
Mm-hmm. There must be something unsaid here about her connection with the Israelites.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. They were relatives, you know, related to Moses' father-in-law.
Is there any possibility that when he came to her, that at least before him, that he was trying to have sex with her? And there's a lot of.
Well, for one thing, you wouldn't have a if a man came to a woman's tent, it would be rather unconventional for them to go in. That's
he was running
unusual.
For his life. I mean,
yeah,
he got
exactly.
His chariot, he was running on foot. I mean, he was
hungry. And I can't really remember really exactly the connection, but her connections of Yael with Anat when Baal is swallowed by, I forget the octopus looking type god, but I've heard, who was it? A couple of weeks ago, this story was used in connection with that Canaanite.
Oh, mm-hmm. Oh, okay. I don't know the comparison. I have to look. You know, we only have a couple of minutes, and I wanted to raise that. We have three women here. We have Rahab, the foreign woman who's a traitor to her people and allows the conquest of allows the Israelites to conquer the land. We have Deborah, the judge and the leader of the people into battle, and we also have Yael, who's also a foreigner but related, who ends up killing the military leader here. And so, what I wanted to point out with these stories is once again that. Women are present in the different periods of Israelite biblical history, and here they're present in the stories of the conquest. Now, the whole tradition of conquest and of the holy war and of the slaughtering of all, you know, the enemies, and kind of a holy war. They're all consecrated to God, and so they're all wiped out. This is one that's, of course, very problematic, I feel, and. We've kind of, at different periods in our own history, for example, in you know, our manifest destiny, and when the Puritans considered the Indians as kind of, you know, the enemy to be wiped out completely, we've sort of followed in this tradition, a very problematic tradition. But what I wanted to point out with these three examples is that, at least in the biblical story, women are also involved in this point in history, and I guess it raises a question for me. Often today we idealize women as somehow, you know, having more compassion or more kindness, and if women were in charge, you know, things would be better. Well, maybe that's true. But on the other hand, I think that the involvement of these women in these stories, for me anyway, kind of makes me think that we're all part of the same humanity, and we might tend to get caught up in the same kinds of things that aren't always so positive. Anyway, reactions to these women and their role in Israelite history. How do you?
One of the things about Deborah that I really find very, very fascinating is the fact that she's not only a judge, but at a time when this Barak really is shows signs of weakening and weakness, that she basically is almost is general. Get up and go, it's time. And he really didn't want to. And I find that very interesting, that there are times in, not only in scripture, but in our everyday lives where there's always a strong woman behind a man who is in power, I should have said. I find that fascinating.
I think it even goes beyond, yeah, you have a good point, she's behind him. But it even goes beyond that in saying that, you know, she accompanies them to battle and rouses the troops herself and so forth. So she's not only behind the force behind the scenes, but she's the leader.
She's more like the commander-in-chief.
The commander-in-chief. Yeah,
of the other generals.
Kind of like Margaret Thatcher.
That's true.
I think it's significant that in a patriarchal society you'd even have this recording. And it always strikes me as kind of a God's grace coming through in spite of people. The fact that there'd be four women in Christ's genealogy in Matthew was unheard of in that culture. You'd never have a woman in a genealogy, you know, listed that way. And to have it listed that there would even be some stories of women, I think is really significant.
I do too. The structures are patriarchal, and yet you have these images of very strong women.
Which, but isn't that historically, isn't it always been shown as Joan of Arc, or in more recent times, in a very patriarchal society like India, there's Indira Gandhi, where there's a strong woman who often is tougher than a lot of the men because they feel they have to be.
Which kind of points out the limitations of our saying, okay, you know, this sex is in charge or whatever, because actually these stories point out that there's power within both of the sexes, and it's going to come out even though the structures of society may not encourage it.
Yeah, I think it's basically a human weakness, men and women, when they have power, that they really exploit it in worse ways. I think we like to think as women that, especially with this new trend of transformational leadership and bringing out a sensitive female styles of women's leadership, everything would be okay. But I'm afraid in England we've got Margaret Thatcher, and she did a lot of destruction in quite a short time. And I think people here are very scared of Hillary Clinton too, that sort of fear.
Yeah, she had to start baking cookies.
Power behind the throne.
I'm all for. I don't want to make it sound like I'm all for sort of the new direction and you know, more consensual decision making and so forth. And you know, however we express it, if we're talking about, you know, bringing the feminine ways of being into decision making, I'm for it. But on the same time, I'm not so convinced that that's inherently a feminine trait. So, anyway, there was a hand up here.
Oh, I thought it was interesting to notice the emphasis on hospitality, because in Greek culture, in the mythology of the Greek gods, they believed in the hospitality to strangers, and it was a law that Zeus handed down. And one of the stories tells about Zeus and taking on the form of a man and taking one of the other and visiting a humble peasant and his wife. And then the story goes on to tell about how they took him in and then how greatly they were blessed by Zeus. They didn't know until afterwards that he was the king of the gods, and but they were greatly blessed because of the hospitality.
Yeah, this was right, a law in that whole region. Well, we've got to quit because we're out of time, but thank you very much for your comments and participation. Good stories, even if they're terrible.
Yeah.